This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is August 12, 2009. This is another interview session with Ted Crabb, Emeritus Director of the Memorial Union. Ted, as we move to the conclusion of this interview, there were several areas that we still needed you to comment on, and one that I think you have some further observations on is Porter Butts and his role with the Union and your relationship with him.
Sure. One of the things I wanted to talk about, Bob, was the change in the university environment that began to happen at the end of Porter's tenure as director. Up until the, early 60s, first of all, you had a campus that at that time was probably 20,000 students, mm-hmm. and of which the majority were undergraduates. It was a campus that had all kinds of rules and regulations of where people could live and what kinds of social activities they could engage in. It was a campus in which it was just the University of Wisconsin-Madison, mm-hmm. And it was a campus in which the Union and Porter were major players for the social and cultural life of the campus. Mm-hmm. Starting in the early to mid-60s, I would trace this to the time that Fred Harrington became president of the university. A major change started to happen, and that carried through, in some respects, for the next decade, up into the early 70s. What happened was that the campus began to grow in size. As new faculty members were hired, they were specifically the pressure was on to look for faculty members from outside who did not have a university connection, mm-hmm. and so there wasn't that what used to be a collegiality among faculty, because many of whom had been graduate students here and had really fit right in. There was also a broadening of the number of departments, and what this did was it really changed the role of the Union and how the Union was, what the Union was doing to service the campus. Starting in the mid-60s, in 1966 or so, was the start of the whole Vietnam protest era, and Porter retired in 68. Well, what happened in that period was that Porter was less and less in touch with what was happening among students at the time, mm-hmm. and was uncomfortable in the situation, and found it very difficult to relate. There were a lot of rules and regulations that had been established, a lot of precedent, a lot of procedures, and a lot of ways of doing things which suddenly were being challenged. And Porter was not good at that, and the students sensed it, and they responded to even make it more difficult. And so by the time Porter retired in 68, in my view, mm-hmm. he was not a happy camper. Mm-hmm. The campus had changed. There was now a central administration. It still wasn't merger time yet, because that didn't happen until the early 70s, 73 or so. But there was a central administration with Fred Harrington was president of the central administration, and Robin Fleming was in the middle to late 60s was the chancellor of the Madison campus. Mm-hmm. And so again, that was another example of this changing campus environment. Many of the old people that were in top administrative positions who had been there for years and who were Porter's colleagues, and in some of the cases, even his classmates in school, were retiring or dying, and so there was a whole change in this relationship with the union and the university. So at the time when Porter retired, that 6-year period roughly from 62 until 68 was a very difficult time. Mm-hmm. And it was a time when I started in 68, in the summer of 68, mm-hmm. it was a difficult time on campus. And so those two forces were converging. And it was, in many respects, although I didn't appreciate it at the time, but in many respects, looking back on it, I really felt sorry for Porter, because he had done so much for the union. He was the godfather of the union. Mm-hmm. And it was his concept of the role of the union that made the union the institution that it was and is. And all of a sudden, a lot of those fundamental structures that set this up were falling apart. Mm-hmm. I remember one conversation I had with Porter, and he was saying, "Well, you can't do that." And I said, "Well, Porter, I don't have a choice on this. This is a university change in university regulation. Well, they can't make that change. I worked this out with A.W. Peterson, who was vice president of business and finance. That was all cleared with Pete, and this was the way it's to be." Well, that may have been mm-hmm. at the time it was done, but times have changed. And that concept of change for Porter was just an extremely difficult one to cope with. And I think that it really made his retirement unfortunate and created a lot of antagonism towards the university, towards students, of the new level of student leaders, and who didn't appreciate how much he had done to make the union what it was. Mm-hmm. So it's an element that I think really provides a setting for the time of his retirement and my taking over as director of the union.
Now, Ted, he had an office in the union.
Yeah.
After he retired. Yeah.
That's an interesting story, too.
Yeah, talk about that.
At the time of his retirement, prior to the time he retired, at least in the minds of the university, and the people who worked with him on his retirement, one of the conditions was that the university would provide an office, but it would not be in the union.
Oh.
And after his retirement, in that fall of 68, we met, and he said that that I've been told that my office is to be up in Bascom, and I refuse to be there. And if I don't have an office in the Memorial Union, then I'm out. I will not have anything to do with the union or the university. And of course, here I am, a young whippersnapper, just starting the job, and who am I to challenge Porter? Who am I to challenge the university? And the university had made it very clear to him that his office would be provided in Bascom, period. And I finally decided, no, I needed Porter and needed his wisdom and counsel and his connections with alumni, and that one way or another I would live with having him around. Now, I knew in advance that the reason the university had stipulated that he have an office in Bascom was that they didn't want him interfering in the day-to-day operations. Mm-hmm. And but I met with the vice chancellor for administration, and together we agreed that the vice chancellor agreed that he would accept my recommendation that Porter would have a space in the union. He was half-time and continued as a half-time position for 10 years until 1978 or 79. And in hindsight, it was a good decision. I don't regret the decision at all. He offered valuable counsel. On the other hand, he also, it made it very difficult in terms of we were continually back and forth on issues that where he had a very strong philosophical position of of, you know, this is the way it was and this is the way it shall be. And yet it was at a time in which this might have been the way it was, but those conditions have totally changed and we're not doing it that way any longer.
Ted, you said you don't regret the decision. And I just want to ask you about that again.
Mm-hmm.
If you had it to do over,
mm-hmm.
When you came in 68, would you still have kept him?
Yeah, yeah. Because in spite of all of the difficulties and dealing with him on a personal basis,
mm-hmm.
He offered great wisdom and he offered all kinds of contacts with alumni that, and for example, in the area of fundraising, mm-hmm. in which he had just all these contacts that had been built up over 50 years,
mm-hmm.
Which was very valuable and could not have been replaced. And so, yes, I would have done it again. On the other hand, it was also a case that I reached a position with Porter in which I had said that I didn't want him, I wanted all of his relations in terms of the union to be through me and not dealing with other staff members.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew him, I knew what our issues were, and I wanted it to come direct and not being filtered through staff members who would be put in a position of not knowing what to do and how to respond to Porter. And Porter honored that commitment too, or he honored that request that he deal with me.
Ted, in view of how you opened this session about the university changing dramatically, was Porter able to be a positive, maintain a positive reaction toward the union?
I think so. In the big picture, I would say yes. On individual parts of it, I would say that was, I wouldn't be as optimistic. But overall, in the big picture, he still had a, he was still proud of union and proud of what he had accomplished. I mean, he was very, he was an egotist. He personally took great pride in what the union was and saw it as his achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And, but with rare exception, I think overall, he was still proud of the union. And he didn't agree with lots of things that were happening at the time, but he, you know, he drew a curtain, in a sense, between what was and what is. And he still felt positive towards the union.
So he could be an effective fundraiser and say that the union, you should still give money to the union.
Oh, yeah, and he did that. I mean, for example, his class of 1924 gave $60,000 at the time. The 50th class reunion in 1964, a gift from a class of $60,000 was significant. He encouraged his wife, who was in the class of, he encouraged another staff member in the class of 25 to make their class gift to the union. He worked with Lowell Frauchy and with his wife's class. Lowell was 27 and his wife was 28, to make a combined gift between the two classes of over $100,000 that went towards the lakefront improvement project that the Hoofers were involved in at that time. He made contact with the classes of 32 and 34, and so he had, among alumni, he was a very effective, he knew the people who were in the leadership positions, and when classes would organize to work towards a class reunion project, he knew all the people,
mm-hmm.
and he could go to them and be very persuasive, and they responded. In fact, we reached a point with the university, and I don't remember for sure when this was, but we reached a point with the university where finally, with the foundation, where the university and foundation said to the union, hey, give somebody else a chance. You've been doing too well on these class gifts, and others are interested in making approaches to the classes. Mm-hmm. But that group of classes from 1924 through 1928 was when the building campaign drive was underway and when the building opened, and so those were logical class gifts for the union. But then it continued on, and we went through a period. We had class of 24, 25, 27, 28, 29, 32, 34, 36, 37, 39, with the opening of the, or 30, 39, 43. I mean, we just did very well during that period.
Yes.
For class reunions.
Indeed.
And Porter was instrumental in many of those contacts. Mm-hmm. So he was willing to and was proud of listing the union. And when he would, a class would, when a class would agree to take on a union project, he stuck with that and made sure that things were moving along and that that it was going to come out the way he had made his commitments to the class.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe this is a good point to segue to the building association.
Mm-hmm.
For the record, talk about what that is.
Well, you have to go back to the early 20s, when, actually 1919-20, when the Board of Regents under Walter Kohler approved a recommendation to designate a proposal to build a union as a memorial union and dedicated to those who lost their lives, those university faculty and students who lost their lives in the country's wars.
Mm-hmm.
And so they established a union building committee. It was the first time that the university had ever reached out to alumni to say, contribute back to the university. There was no alumni records office, and they had 90,000 or so graduates of the university, and they had the names, and they have only 2,000 names.
Wow.
And addresses.
Really?
Yeah. And in fact, Porter's first job upon graduating was to be the director of alumni records. And he built the initial record system for tracing alumni. I remember hearing, he used to tell the story how they'd go to a community and run ads in the newspaper saying, all UW alumni turn out at such and such a time for a alumni function. And they would collect and they would collect names and addresses and ask people who attended to list the names and addresses of their friends who were UW graduates. That's how they built the Alumni Records Office initially. It was on a dresser graph plates.
Oh, sure.
Sure. But anyway, the Union Building Committee was the fundraising avenue. There was no UW Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the first time the university ever asked alumni and students to make a donation to the university. And they raised in total pretty close to $1 million in the 20s for the union, for the first two sections of the Memorial Union Building. Then in mid-30s, the proposal came along to add the theater, and the union was able to obtain a PWA grant, Public Works Administration grant.
Mm-hmm.
For a major portion of the theater cost, and raise some additional monies plus operating funds to make up the difference to build a theater. Again, the Union Building Committee was the avenue that was established to do that. And those were the days when the Regents were a Madison campus, or the university was the Regents in the Madison campus.
Mm-hmm.
So the building committee then in 1951, the decision was made to reconstitute the Union Building Committee and incorporate it as the Memorial Union Building Association and become a 501c3 organization. Now the UW Foundation, meanwhile, had been organized by the university, and I think that was in the late 40s. And their first fund drive was for the Wisconsin Center, which is now the Pyle Center, as you know. And so the UW Foundation was already established by this time, and the union organized this Memorial Union Building Association to be able to continue to raise funds for the support and welfare of the Union Building. It continued the relationship in terms of union membership. Up to that point, going back to the time of the fund drive back in the 20s, anyone who gave, I think it was $50, it might have been $100, but I think it was $50, anyone who gave $50 or more became a life member of the Memorial Union Building. And this was, what it basically said was that upon graduation, that you can come back and come to the union and be welcome. And it also established, importantly, for the union, the recognition of the union as being a membership organization. And there were, in the 30s, several lawsuits brought against the union by local restaurants and groups who challenged the fact that the union was competing in unfair competition. And that went to court, and they were always tossed out because the union was a membership organization. It wasn't open to just anybody. You had to pay a membership fee to be a member. So this whole membership concept had developed over a long period of time since the building first opened. And the Memorial Union Building Association continued that membership nature of the union and became the vehicle through which those membership receipts were deposited.
Ted, when you were incorporated as a 501c3, was there an effort on the part of the UW Foundation to bring the Building Association under its purview?
Not that I'm aware of.
Uh-huh.
And the people who incorporated were all the big names in the university. George Hates, John Lords, Lowell Frauchy. You can go down Stanley Allen. You can go down the list of all of the big name university alumni were all part of this Memorial Union Building Association, and I know that there was a lot of commonality between members of the Building Association and the UW Foundation, but I have never seen or heard of any effort that was made to meld the two bodies. Up to that point, I can remember seeing letters, descriptions of how the university had three fundraising arms, the UW Foundation, the Memorial Union Building Association, and WARF. Mm-hmm. And there were, I remember seeing this in back of alumni magazines, for example, to describe the relationship of these fundraising organizations. And from the standpoint of the Memorial Union Building Association, this is a long-standing relationship that went back to the early 20s, that just had morphed into this new animal called the Memorial Union Building Association. But I don't know of any attempt or effort that was made to incorporate. Now, initially, carrying on that question, initially the union deposited its monies into its own account, and then I'm not sure when this happened, but I know either shortly after I got here, or I'm not sure whether it's happened before, but at any rate, the union had its own, the union would deposit its monies through the foundation. Mm-hmm. And that may have been when back in the early 70s when Ed Young, as chancellor, specifically urged the foundation to recognize the union as one of its regular ongoing accounts. And that might have been the point in which we started depositing our funds in the foundation. And the foundation being open to establish endowment funds for the union.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect that probably is when it happened.
So how has the Building Association evolved as an organization up to today?
Well, the Building Association has two primary focuses, three, but two in terms of functioning. One is, it's the fundraising arm for the union.
Mm-hmm.
And so it allocates, it gets money and it allocates those money for various improvements in programs and services. And secondly, the Building Association has served as a mechanism to give feedback to the union on whether or not and how the union is serving its members. Mm-hmm. And some of that, for example, came through starting in the early 70s when we had a series of what were then called residencies, in which organized under the auspices of the Building Association, it would be a group of alumni and faculty and students who would meet on particular topics to talk about the union. And I remember the first one, which was 1972-73, in which the focus of that one was the whole issue of the Vietnam War and how it has affected the union. Mm-hmm. And it gave an outsider's view, in a sense. The staff just provided information. It was not the staff providing the narrative. Mm-hmm. It was the residency team providing the narrative.
Oh.
That would provide information to the union, advice to the union on how things are going on particular topics. And we've had probably 10 or 15 residencies over time on various issues where they've been very valuable in providing a different perspective in terms of how the union is fulfilling its mission of serving its members, which is, as I said, is one of the primary roles of the Building Association. But the fundraising has become more and more important, and one of the changes over time has been the increasing importance of fundraising for the union. And the Building Association is like so many colleges now that have their own, what you call it, Board of Visitors or whatever. This is the same kind of thing. And the union, we've had good success over time. Each year when the foundation lists where the monies are designated among university departments and colleges, obviously the business school, the engineering school, the medical school, the athletic department are all big numbers. Mm-hmm. But then after you get over those four or five major colleges and departments, the union has been number six or number seven. Mm-hmm. Year in and year out, and we've had very great success in the Building Association. Has in effect been responsible for, has been the focal point for upwards of somewhere in the neighborhood $8 to $10 million in gifts to the union over history. So it's been very valuable to the union. It has enabled the union to do things both physically and programmatically that it otherwise would not have been able to do. And it's been able to establish endowments to enable us to carry on activities that potentially we've not been able to do.
Does that include support for hoofers?
It has included support for hoofers. In terms of hoofers, the Building Association has given three or four major grants to hoofers for specific physical improvements in hoofers. For example, I mentioned earlier this classes of 27 and 28, mm-hmm. which did the Lakefront Improvement Project. Well, that project included not only money from the classes, but it also included a gift from the Building Association and some operating funds to generate enough money to see that project through. They gave money for the refurbishing of the Hoofers' quarters. They gave money for the redo of the class of 52 gave money for the redo of the lakefront at the base of Park Street. And again, this was through the Building Association taking the lead to submit a proposal to the class to provide funds for that project. So yes, they have done a lot, and the plans for the addition to the union now that are in the works includes another major investment for Hoofers.
Now, how do you get on the Building Association?
There are two classifications of members. One is the trustees, and the other is associate trustees. And to be a trustee, you have to be an associate trustee. And there is a nominating committee that makes nominations. And what they're looking for are people who have shown over time, either as students or as non-students, a particular interest or knowledge or awareness of the union. Mm-hmm. And they're elected first as an associate trustee, and then depending on the vacancies, there are 24 trustees plus 3 students who are trustees by virtue of their student leadership positions.
Now, Ted, I know because she's a friend of mine, the union hired Glenda Noel May,
mm-hmm. yes.
to work as a development director. Does she work for the building association?
No, she is a university employee, she's a union employee, but the building association provides some of the cost of her operations as a fundraiser, mm-hmm. so that there's a split funding for some of the costs now.
Oh, I see.
Her appointment is as a union staff member, paid for by the union. But as I say, then the trustees pay for part of the costs of that whole office operation of the fundraising office.
Is she the first full-time fundraiser?
First full-time fundraiser, right.
Mm-hmm.
Over the past, 30 years or so, we've had a part-time person who has been, technically has been a membership director, but who also would write grant requests and would be involved in fundraising whenever there were suggestions to meet with classes, for example, and contact with the foundation. But Glenda's relationship with the foundation is significantly more than anything we've ever had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good, too.
So is it set up now that if a foundation development officer encounters someone who loves the union, and that's where he or she wants to put their money, does that name now come from the foundation to you?
It's supposed to. And conversely, if Glenda wants to see someone, she will check with the foundation to, in a sense, get clearance to see that person.
Mm-hmm.
So that there is that connective link between Glenda's position and the foundation.
Now, are you continuing to do things with the business building association?
At the time Porter retired, let me think now. What was the timing on this? At the time I retired, I was elected as treasurer of the Building Association.
Oh.
And up to that point, Porter had been treasurer. Up to the point where Porter retired as active involvement as an emeritus director, which was about the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
He had been the early 90s. He had been the treasurer. And then when I retired in 2000, I was elected as treasurer. And that gap between one of the other trustees served as treasurer for that roughly 10-year period between Porter's retirement as an active trustee and my retirement as director and emeritus, becoming emeritus status, in which I took over as the treasurer. So I am still the treasurer of the Building Association.
And how often does that meet?
Officially they meet twice a year. They can meet more often as needed, but they officially meet twice a year, and then they have an executive committee that meets as on call.
Mm-hmm.
But they, again, coming back to the purpose of this, and its primary purpose now is a vehicle to through which fundraising is undertaken. And they pay for a significant cost towards the whole fundraising operation.
Mm-hmm.
And the trustees as far as the relationship between the trustees and the union, it is strictly advisory. But it's an advisory, very close advisory relationship with the union operating structure.
And does the current director of the union sit with that group mm-hmm. as
he
well?
He's the executive secretary of that group.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Some of the other areas we wanted to address, the segregated fee history. What is that about?
Well, again, some background to prepare for this discussion. At the time, back in 1927, when the union was about to open, there was a student faculty committee appointed by the then president to develop a constitution and prepare the financial position for how the building would operate. And they recommended what was then called an incidental fee to be used for the operation and maintenance of the new union building. And that was approved by the Regents in 1927. Mm-hmm. And the fee was set at a level that would provide funding for a major portion of the non-revenue generated costs of operating the union. Mm-hmm. And this continued up until it changed at some point in the 60s to become known as the segregated fee, but the fee had continued up until the point of merger in 1973, in which with merger there suddenly were 9 state colleges and 4 state universities that were all part of one university system, and they all had some kinds of segregated fees, and in some cases, and in most cases, those segregated fees were used to support student activities such as the newspaper, the yearbook, and even in most cases in the state university, in the state college system, they were used to support athletics. Mm-hmm. While at Madison, because of the numbers of students involved, the fees were limited to initially just to health service and to this union incidental fee. Then in the 60s, a rec sports fee was added, but those were the three activities that the segregated fee was used for in the Madison campus. And at the time of merger, the legislature, in adopting the merger legislation, included provisions for continuation of the segregated fee, and specified that there would also be a fee, a segregated fee could be established to provide for the support of student activities. And this was done at the behest of the state colleges presidents and students and faculty, because they were afraid if the Madison model were applied to them, it would wipe out all of the support that the segregated fee was having for this variety of student programs. Mm-hmm. And so it was included in the merger legislation, and it had two parts. One was it provided for that there be a fee for student activities that would be recommended by student government, by the agency on campus recognized as having a student majority. And then it also provided that a section that said that students shall be active participants in the governance as it relates to student social activities. And so when this was adopted by the legislature and became the part of the regent procedures, the university had to develop mechanisms for implementing this, and initially they developed a set of standards that fortunately, from the standpoint of the Memorial Union, were very similar to the standards that were being followed for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Oh. And we had, our governing board was, Union Council was 9 students and 6 non-students, and the Board of Regents designated that, stipulated that the Union Council on the Madison campus would be one of these student agencies that would be recognized as that would be responsible for approving student segregated fees for the use of programs in support of the unions. And that was most of the other campuses. The answer was that it would be the student government. And on the Madison campus, the Regents took the position that both the union and the student government would fall under this category of having a student majority. So this was a very significant decision for the Wisconsin Union. The Regents, as I said, adopted this policy on the use of segregated fees, and it followed the Madison campus model. And fortunately, we really have had one period in time, we've had very good support from the administration and from the Regents on the segregated fee. The one period of time was in the early 70s when the Regents, because of the financial conditions in the state, froze any increases in segregated fees. Mm. And at the same time, costs were going up. Mm-hmm. And finally that logjam was broken. And the Regents, or the University Administration, the System Administration, and the Regents approved some fee increases that opened the door for beginning to recognize the fact that you needed to have a cost of doing business. Now, interestingly, the Building Association and the Union Council were instrumental in petitioning the administration and the Regents to change their procedures to allow for to free up the increases in the segregated fee. at the time, Lowell Frouchy, who was chair of the trustees, made an appearance at the Regent meeting, urging the Regents to endorse a fee increase for, particularly for the Madison campus, for the union, but saying that this was needed system-wide. But it was specifically for the union. And that came with the support from Ed Young as chancellor of the Madison campus, encouraging Lowell to go to the Regents directly to make this appeal, because Ed recognized the difficult time that the union was facing. And other health service was facing it, the rec sports program was facing it. So that the trustees, in their role of being there to support the union, it's another illustration of how valuable they were over time.
Okay, that's helpful. That's a good piece of history that I'm glad we have it.
The other part of this, just a further sidelight, as you probably know, the whole segregated fee policy was eventually challenged by Southwick, mm-hmm. and went all the way to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court ruled that the whole idea of a segregated fee was appropriate, but that also the university had to be clear in specifying to make sure. The issue in that case was whether or not the allocation of student portion of the student activity portion of the segregated fee was discriminating against certain kinds of students. And the Supreme Court said the allocation of fees for student organizations was appropriate, but the university had to make clear that there was a neutral allocation of fees by those who were allocating the fee.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah.
Interesting that it got all the way to the Supreme Court.
Certainly was.
I bet you talked with your wife about
that. On occasion, we used to chat about that. Yeah. But for the union, this was critical. And yes. We were really worried what would happen if the court ruled on the other side of the, as Judge Sabaz did at the district court level. And we were very concerned about what the effect would be on the union. Had this held, the appeals court reversed the district court, and then it was appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court sided with the appeals court.
Let me ask you to turn your attention to the demise of the International Club at the union.
This is
what
just
was it, yeah. And what happened?
Oh, this is just an interesting sidelight in history. The International Club was founded on the campus, I think it was in 1903. It was founded on the campus, international students at the University of Wisconsin, with the idea that it would be a sort of a mini United Nations that would bring foreign students together to meet each other. Mm-hmm. And provided a strong support group of not only university personnel, but also City of Madison people who are interested in foreign students, that would have them invite foreign students for the holiday programs, and then would provide winter clothing for those students who didn't have coats and boots and so forth. At any rate, it had a long history of running a wide-ranging program of providing opportunities for different cultures to talk about their cultures for the benefit of others, both other international students and also American students. And I've been very successful. And then starting in the late 60s, early 70s, as tensions began to rise among various countries, it became a problem that if the International Club would sponsor a forum on something relating to Israel, the Palestinians wouldn't attend. Or if the Indians had a program, the Pakistanis wouldn't attend. Or if the if there was a program on Greece, the few students who were there from Croatia wouldn't attend. And it exacerbated to the point where by 1972-73, the whole organization ceased to function because it was so torn apart by these nationalist conflicts that they couldn't find commonality to be willing to come together and work them out, forgetting that this was to be a social setting and a social meeting. They couldn't come together, and so the club just folded up its tent and said, "We're done." So it was a real tragedy because it really served a wonderful purpose.
It had really existed to provide a second home for international students to talk about the challenge of being a foreign student.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm guessing.
Absolutely. And they worked closely with the International Student Office on campus. There was a Madison Friends of International Students in the Madison community that worked very closely with them. And it was, as you describe it, and you're absolutely right, this was a group that's primary mission was to facilitate the interaction of international students and the developing a comfort level for international students as they tried to merge into the campus scene. And it was really very tragic. But there was just no way that they were able to resolve this dilemma of how you can deal with things when you had these conflicting feelings of two different sides, and they weren't willing to talk.
It really is kind of sad, isn't it, that if a club can't, mm-hmm. with kids can't work it out,
yeah.
what hope is
yeah.
there for the nation
yeah.
states?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you made a note about the relationship of the Union Theater to the Oscar Mayer when the mm-hmm. Madison Civic Center mm-hmm. opened mm-hmm. or was created, and then the impact of Overture Center.
Well, I this think it's valuable to mention that up until early to mid 70s, the Union Theater was the only theater in town, mm-hmm. and it was the center of the cultural arts, mm-hmm. in the broadest sense of the word. And with the opening of the redo of the Capitol Theater on State Street and its refurbishing and designation as the Oscar Mayer Theater, for the first time the Union had some real competition, mm-hmm. and there was a real adjustment period as we both struggled to determine what our role and our mission was and what was our niche of the cultural market. And it wasn't just in terms of the Union Theater, it also related to the arts, because on campus it was both the Union Art Program and the Elvium suddenly having real competition from the Madison Art Center, mm-hmm. and which had expanded by that time. So, but in particular as it related to the cultural program, all of a sudden the Union had this competition, and the first couple years of the new Oscar Mayer Theater, we were in deep financial trouble, where we tried to have a program and the audience split hers was spending its money, and neither the Union nor the Oscar Mayer Theater came out financially in those years, mm-hmm. and we had to settle down and figure out what it was that we could each do, mm-hmm. and what was the niche for each of these facilities. And then with the coming of Overture, this all happened again even more so, because the Overture Center had not only the one large theater, but it had that still had the Oscar Mayer Theater under a new name, and several additional smaller spaces. And so it really incorporated a major cultural center. And the Union, and this also happened at a time in which artist fees were escalating to the point where, while we had 1,300 seats, we couldn't afford the big name artists any longer. We couldn't afford the orchestras any longer. And so what we ended up having to do was to say, okay, we have to restrict our program to soloists and to chamber orchestras to a certain extent, but even more so to quartets and quintets. Mm-hmm. And we just can't afford to do this, and those are going to be taken over by first by the Civic Center and later by Overture Center. Mm-hmm. And this was a real adjustment. And it also entailed trying to achieve some coordination on when these two facilities were programming, so that you weren't competing for the same audience on the same night.
And how effective was that?
Well, I was just going to say that it's been pretty good. It's worked pretty well. There have been a few conflicts where things have happened on the same night. But by and large, I think both sides, both the Union and the city, recognize that it made good sense to work together and try to avoid direct conflict in terms of events. Because there is a limited market, and we're all struggling to get our share of the pie, but when you put the pie on the same night, nothing's going to win. And so overall, I think that it's worked pretty well, but it certainly has been a lot of effort has gone in to try and make it work well.
Is the Union Theater now and its program essentially stable, or are you worried about its future?
I'm worried about its future. I think it's stable, but the problems are these. Before the Civic Center, we used to average 1,200 people for every performance, almost sold out. Now we're down to under 1,000 per performance. In fact, 800-900 per performance, and we back in the '80s we had a major fund raising effort to raise, to create an endowment for the Theater Program Endowment Fund. And the purpose of that was to have money that would be generated on an annual basis, which could be used in part to subsidize artist fees and in part to have a subsidized student ticket prices to try and get students to attend cultural events in the theater. And that's, you know, while that's been a very significant in providing a financial base, it's still, we could use more because it's a very competitive market. And as I say, the number of seats you have is a fixed number of seats. As the artist fees escalated and you had to raise ticket prices, it was just making that much more difficult to get people. And a third factor that entered in here is that, in particularly in Madison, although this is true in, I suspect, in most every college community, but particularly in Madison, the large number of families in which the husband and wife are both working. And it used to be back in the old days, the husband worked and the wife stayed home. And the wife was the one who was interested in going out on a night to attend cultural events because it was a way to get out of the house. Now, instead of buying series tickets for the whole season, people are making choices. Well, should we go here for this particular event? Should we go there for this particular event? And as in the current economy, they're also making further choices of how much money do we want to spend on cultural events. And so there's a lot of picking and choosing going on. Used to be that, and again, you're an observer of this whole scene, used to be that you would sell a series event for the whole series. And now you can pick and choose which events you want to go to and make up your own series. And all of this is a marketing effort to try to capture as much of the audience as you possibly can, and using every technique you can think of to try to capture that audience. And we and the Civic Centers or the Overture is having to face this same kind of thing in a way. We used to have Yo-Yo Ma, Yasha, these big names would be regular concert performers in the theater. Well, I don't know where he is now, but I know that at one point not too long ago, Yo-Yo Ma's fee was $75,000. And there's no way we can generate $75,000 in a 1,300-seat house. Sure, we'd sell out the theater, but we wouldn't even begin to. You know, if you charged $50 a ticket, let's say, that still wouldn't generate the cost to cover his fee and the cost of the staff to staff the event. And at what point do you reach that breaking point where people aren't going to be willing to spend the money? The Overture Center faced this with the Chicago Symphony, in which they had to price their tickets such that they couldn't fill the house. Because there just weren't that many people that were willing to pay the price.
Right.
And it's a real dilemma for cultural spaces these days of how do you cover those costs. And from Yo-Yo Ma's standpoint, you know, he's saying, look, I don't have to be out on the road every single night. I'm over that. I now can go out when it's to my benefit and people are willing to pay the money for me to be there. I'll be there. But unless you get complete subsidization from surrounding corporate funds, agencies, that really limits his performances to the major metropolitan areas.
And
I'm not picking on Yo-Yo Ma.
No, I understand. It's across the spectrum. But this is just one aspect of what you were talking about off record before we started, about the changing nature of the union and all of its programs to the university, which reflects, I suppose, for lack of a better word, the changing world.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The union lives in.
You know, if you go back, and I'll draw the line again with Porter's retirement. at that point, which was 1968. At that point, in the mid-60s, there were at most roughly 20,000 students on campus. Mm-hmm. And the campus was still fairly evenly divided. One third of the students were lived in university residence halls, about a third of the students, of the undergraduates, mm-hmm. lived in fraternities and sororities, and about a third either lived at home or lived in primarily rental units. And all women had to live in university-approved housing. There were hours for women. All students, any student social event, had to be registered and approved by the university. And you had to have, all student organizations had to submit a constitution and a list of members and a whole series of rules and regulations. And there was a very strong relationship between the university and the students and student organizations. And this is, the union thrived in this. Mm-hmm. There was a, that's when our food services, I mean, the union was the place to get one square meal or one full meal a day. You could have your breakfast food in the morning, you could have a sandwich at lunch, but you needed to have one solid meal, and that was the union. And we had food plans that you could, you'd buy a food plan. Mom and Dad would buy a food plan for the whole semester, and you'd come and have your major meal a day at the union. Well, all of a sudden, in the late 60s, early 70s, that just totally turned around. Women could live where they wanted to. There were no restrictions on hours. The university no longer required the registration of each individual social event on campus, on and on and on. And the relationships dramatically changed. And for the union, this also was a dramatic change. Over that the period in the 70s and into the 80s, and it continues even today, the union is no longer the major provider of food on the campus for students. Mm-hmm. The major provider of food on the campus is either university residence halls or it's students living in apartments where they have their own cooking facilities. Mm-hmm. And the union is there, yes, we provide food, but it's primarily on a grab-and-go basis. It's at delis. It's in the snack bars. Mm-hmm. And it's not at the cafeteria where it used to be. The union isn't the same kind of social center that it used to be. It still is a social center, but it's not the same as it was 40 years ago, in which all the major social events were held on campus. There is no prom any longer. There is no homecoming ball as such. You know, those kinds of major social functions aren't. Now, they're replaced in a variety of different ways. Some are on campus, some are off campus. But it's a totally different world today for the union and its operations as it was 40, 50 years ago.
And how well do you think the union is adapting to the change?
I think it's a mixed bag, and not because the union hasn't doing enough, but it just continues, this pattern of change just continues. And I hadn't mentioned up to this now the whole impact of computers, in which all of a sudden a student in his or her room has access to the university library through a computer. It has changed the whole reading patterns. It changes how you turn in work. Papers, you can do those all in your room. The relationship of the library to the student has changed. The relationship of the union to the student has changed. And what one of the real issues facing the union today is establishing what are the destination points that bring students to the union. What is it that makes a student want to come to the union? Now, some of it is just to meet friends, some of it is to buy that sandwich, some of it is to attend programs of a wide range of everything from hoofer activities to lectures to all kinds of different activities. That's where the union has to continue to push to get students to identify that, hey, the union is the place to be. And you're fighting this real urging of and realization that students don't have to go to the library. They don't have to go to the union like they used to. One of the great stories that this was probably 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, the director of housing was telling about how two students living over in Celery had dropped a wire out of one room down a floor to the room directly below, and they'd hooked up their computers together, and they were just communicating with each other by computer. They never had face-to-face contact, and they were the best of friends. But that friendship wasn't on a personal basis. It was through a computer line. And you know, at the time, I just remember being struck by how, wow, this is really a different age.
And do you feel that 50 years from now that the union will still be here?
Well, I'd like to think so. I do, but I think it's going to take, I think it's a setting where, well, I guess you could start with the question of, is the university going to be here 50 years from now? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is yes. And I think if the university here is going to be here, I think the union's going to be here, because I think there'll continue to be this realization of the importance of having an agency on campus that brings people together, mm-hmm. in which students and faculty can come together and to attend programs, to meet one another, to engage in various activities. And that's the fundamental role of the union. And there's, even though the computers have come and become such a dominant part of the student's life now, there still is the need to get to know one another and to develop a social life and to develop some skills outside of just your classroom experience.
Ted, is the Rathskeller and the Terrace as vital as ever?
Certainly the Terrace is more so. The Terrace has become just a real magnet. Mm-hmm. But that's only from May 1 till October 1. Mm-hmm. And there's the Rathskeller is still important, but it is not as important as it used to be. Part of what used to attract students to the Rathskeller was beer. Well, beer is available any place now, mm-hmm. and the Rathskeller is just one of a variety of beverages that are available, and it isn't the when I was in school and for years afterwards, you never thought about buying a six-pack of beer and taking it to your room. Mm-hmm. It never would occur to you. Mm-hmm. You didn't have a refrigerator there were places you could go to have beer, and whether it was at the Union or even on State Street. But you'd never think about buying beer and taking it to your room. Today, everybody's doing that. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it's the Union has to adapt to these changing conditions. And I think that they're doing that, but it's a real struggle. And it's going to continue to be a real struggle. But it's a critical struggle. Students, in particular, need to have the opportunity to get to know each other, mm-hmm. and to be challenged by other ideas, and to have that interaction, that social interaction that is so important a part of college life. And it's the part that's under great threat right now from a computer that has become such a dominant force for a student.
Ted, as we move to complete this interview, any concluding observations from you about your life and career and the union and or the university itself?
Well, I guess I would start by saying I feel I was very lucky, very fortunate to have had the opportunity to get involved with the union and to become director of the union for 32 years, whatever it was. And that was very, very fortunate. And it was my life. And it was particularly critical for me because I wanted the kind of experience that the union provided. I wanted a job that provided opportunities to be of service to people and to encourage interaction of people. And the union, that's what the union is all about. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge in the future, my hope is that in the future that the university will continue to support the kinds of activities and programs and services that are fundamental in the role of the union. Mm-hmm. The union can do only so much. It has to have support from the campus. And I hope that that the campus will be prepared to provide that support on into the future. Mm-hmm. If they don't, things are going to be very difficult for the union. The union right now is undertaking a major fund drive to raise money to complete a new campus union in the southwest portion of the campus, mm-hmm. and to remodel and update the Memorial Union. And certainly in the case of Memorial Union, a major refurbishing effort is sorely needed. Mm-hmm. And that's going to help. The university, as it has expanded size, the colleges have become more and more important, and with new buildings being added on the campus, they almost invariably have added a lounge and a student reception area. Mm-hmm. And those are serving purposes that the union was originally providing through one central building. Mm-hmm. And it's critical for the university to have the commitment that while on the one hand they're providing these new buildings with these lounges for the colleges, but there still is the need on a campus, even at 40,000 students, for having places to encourage students and faculty to get together, to bring students together from different disciplines so that they can talk about issues and they can learn things that they aren't learning in the classroom. And that requires a cooperative effort between the union and the university. The union can't do it on its own unless it has university support. And when I look at the future, I just see this as one of the major tests for the union as to whether or not they can achieve that kind of university support. It's not only financial support, it's also support from a chancellor saying, the kind of thing I'm talking about is important for students as part of the total learning experience. The university needs to provide this kind of opportunity for students to get together. They need to encourage faculty and staff to meet with students and to gain that, students can learn so much from faculty outside of the classroom as well as in the classroom. And again, the union is integral. Yes, that's right. So I guess that's sort of a summation of my commitment and my feelings.
Let me just conclude this. This now concludes the oral history interview with the very productive and accomplished Ted Craft. Thank you, Ted. This is important for the archives.